Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike.
This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly.
History doesn't have to be boring, buttoned up, or inaccessible. And it certainly didn't end in 1945. It belongs to all of us, and we share and add to it every day. Welcome to the History of Go-Go podcast, where I interview interesting guests, cover a motley crew of topics, and it's a place where you can sit, think, and drink all at the same time. I'm your host, Rob Mellon.
Not only have I lost a wife and two children, but I haven't to move the rest of my family with really no place to go at this point. I believe in forgiveness, but I also believe in justice, and forgiveness doesn't rob justice.
My guest today is investigative reporter, author, and historian Sally Denton. She writes about the subjects others often ignore, from a drug conspiracy in Kentucky to organized crime in Las Vegas, from corruption within the Mormon Church to the hidden history of manifest destiny, and from one of America's bitterest political campaigns to the powerful forces against Franklin Delano Roosevelt. She has an extensive background in print and broadcast, as well as magazine and book writing. Denton has received several awards and honors, including the Guggenheim Fellowship, Stanford University's Hoover Media Fellowship, the New York Times Editor's Choice in March 2016, and the Robert Lasholt Distinguished Writer Award. Her most recent book is The Colony, Faith and Blood in a Promised Land, and that will be our topic of discussion today. Of the book, Publishers Weekly says, "The Colony is an intriguing portrait of fundamentalist Mormons in Mexico, a fascinating tale of religion, violence, and family secrets." And we are very pleased to have the seasoned investigative reporter and outstanding writer with us today. Welcome, Sally.
Thank you.
This is a fascinating story, but I'm wondering, a lot of people may have never heard of these incidents or the family in general. What brought your attention to this story initially?
Well, actually, the event that happened on November 4th, 2019, a caravan of three women and 14 children were driving across a remote road in northern Mexico, not far from the American border, and they were ambushed and attacked by as many as 100 cartel gunmen, sicarios, and it was a cold-blooded assassination, basically. And I first heard about it on CNN right after it happened, and it actually did get a lot of attention from all over the world. And it maintained a lot of attention for, you know, the first several days because of the horrendous, the heinousness of the crime. These were innocent, you know, women and children that were just attacked, and gunfire just rained down on them. And so I first heard it, as I said, on CNN, and then it was followed almost immediately by then President Trump, who was claiming these are American. It made it sound like it was some kind of just random attack on some American women, like tourists or something. And Trump, even before the Mexican government had even gotten to the scene, then President Trump basically announced that, you know, these were cartel hitmen and that the United States should declare them as terrorists, which was a, you know, could be a pretext for the United States entering Mexico militarily. And so that's what first attracted me to it. And then as soon as I started getting into it and realized that these women were basically members of a fundamentalist polygamous sect, I knew from my own previous reporting and writing that this had a lot of historic context that I could bring to it.
Sally, it is tradition here to accompany the conversation with a special brew. Today, we have Sucker Punch Watermelon Sour from the Three Nations Brewing Company of Carrollton, Texas. This sour is made from real candy, crisp and light. The flavor of this Berliner Weiss literally comes out of nowhere. So be very careful, or this beer will sucker punch you too. Remember, the best way to enjoy an episode is with one of our featured brews. This is also my time to ask you to subscribe to the podcast. Subscribing is the only way to get those newest shows right away. And to our ever-expanding legion of listeners and supporters from thousands of cities and towns in 100 countries, I have to say thank you. And now, I raise my Sucker Punch Watermelon Sour very high. And to all of those persistent investigative reporters, photographers, and writers who are on the front lines in some of the toughest places in the world, standing for the truth, I say cheers. So if we go back to the very beginning of the Mormon Church, the founder, Joseph Smith, he didn't originally advocate or preach polygamy, but when that change was made, it must have had a profound impact on the church.
Well, it did, and a lot of people, this is back in the 1830s and 40s, and a lot of people broke away back then, but a lot of people also stayed with the church. I mean, hundreds, thousands of people did stay with the church, and it continued after Joseph Smith was murdered, and Brigham Young took over the church and led the saints, as they were called, to Salt Lake City. Our Great Salt Lake Valley. At the time, there was no city, and it was outside. It was Mexican territory. And the book delves into that, the original practice of polygamy and what that looked like in the 1800s, what it looks like in the 1900s and 21st century. And so it's a fascinating story and complicated by layers of often violent history with this particular clan, this family in Mexico that I focused on for the book.
In the early days of the Mormon Church, what would have been the attraction to polygamy?
Well, initially, you know, Joseph Smith led the, and I'm not an academic, I mean, a Mormon scholar by any means, but I have explored a lot of it in a lot of my journalism and history writing. But basically, you know, this was a brand new faith, and the purpose of the proselytizing that Smith did, and then Brigham Young with enormous success, was to build the kingdom of God on earth. And as part of that, it was to have as many followers as possible, but also it was directly tied. It was all part of the early church was under the leadership of Joseph Smith, was really guided by divine revelations that Smith got. And so he was dictating what was going to be the most important doctrine. He wrote the Book of Mormon. And then polygamy later became key to the kingdom of God on earth. And also there's the celestial kingdom, that the more wives a man had, the larger his kingdom in heaven would be. And then it was integrally tied to women getting to the celestial kingdom with their men by being pulled through the veil, as they call it.
You know, the Mormons, Joseph Smith, obviously he's a target of violence himself. He's murdered at Carthage Jail. The Mormons had to contend with a lot of violence in the very beginning directed toward them. It seems looking back from the very beginning, violence has been a part of Mormon history. And of course, as we know, violence often begets violence.
Well, I think because they were so different, they were not traditional Christian faith in the early days, and they were really seen as the other. And then the practices of polygamy and other practices, anointings and things, they set themselves apart from their neighbors, and then ultimately even almost declared war with America. Joseph Smith ran for president in 1844, advocating for a theocratic nation state. But they set themselves apart, and the more they did that, the more they antagonized their neighbors. And then the more that their practices of baptisms and then ultimately the very controversial doctrine of blood atonement, which was to, you know, kill somebody to save their soul. And it just escalated from there. Now, as you go through history, as they go from New York and then Nauvoo and on to Utah, they're gathering enemies along the way. And then they set themselves up apart in the kind of the fastness of the Rocky Mountains as a kind of strange and distant land, as I said, then outside the boundaries of the United States. So they were just almost poised from the beginning to be at odds with their neighbors.
There was an extremely violent incident out west involving Mormons in 1857. What happened at the Mountain Meadows Massacre?
That's when a wagon train that was traversing the United States from Arkansas to California, it was the wealthiest wagon train to ever travel across the continent. And it was a family, the Fancher family, that basically was relocating from Arkansas to California. This is just post-gold rush days. And they had 1,000 head of longhorn cattle and very valuable thoroughbred horses. And they had basically had been in Arkansas for several generations and were picking up stakes and moving entirely to land in the Central Valley of California to start a huge cattle and horse breeding operation. And they were lured by the Mormons in Salt Lake to go down toward what was still Utah territory into this meadow, mountain meadows. And ultimately they were ambushed and attacked and slaughtered by a group of Mormon militia who dressed like Paiute Indians. 140 people were killed. And the only reason that we even know about it is that there were 17 children under the age of 8, which is the age of innocence in the Mormon faith, that were spared, and they ultimately testified to U.S. Congress and said they watched their fathers and mothers and siblings murdered by Indians. And when it was all over, the Indians washed off their faces and they were white men. So there was direct testimony from the survivors. It was the most horrendous massacre in American history, white on white. In fact, I think it remained the most victims and the most really brutal massacre up until the Oklahoma City bombing in the 20th century.
Well, I guess that history is one of violence on both sides then.
On both sides, there was a lot of violence, as you pointed out, against the Mormons. But it's important to state here that the group that I write about and that were killed in northern Mexico, they were offshoots of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church. And they broke away and their leaders were excommunicated by the church for practicing polygamy. So this is not a group that the church condones or associates with or apologizes for. This is a kind of an outlaw sect, if you will.
There did indeed come a time in Mormon history when their leader, Wilford Woodruff, decided that the cycle of violence could not continue, that if the church was going to survive, the problems between the United States and the Mormons had to end. He issues a manifesto which outlawed polygamy, and the result of that were several different sects breaking off from the church, including the focus of your book, the LeBaron family.
Well, right. Well, first of all, the Wilford Woodruff, who had become president of the church after Brigham Young was dead, he's the one who made, it was really a conciliatory decision with the United States government. The U.S. government was not going to grant Utah statehood unless they held somebody accountable for the Mountain Meadow Massacre and if they officially abandoned polygamy, which they did both. They presented John D. Lee, who ultimately would be executed. He was a very close associate of Brigham Young, and he would be executed for leading the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And then they abandoned polygamy. At that point, the polygamists then left Utah and went to outlying regions of Mexico. And they saw these were the purists. They believed that what Woodruff had done was really to make a concession with the United States and that polygamy was such a divine and instrumental integral doctrine within the faith that it was blasphemous. They thought he was a usurper to the throne. So they saw themselves as the true believers. And in the early years, in the 1890s, the church really helped them relocate to Mexico. In fact, the Mormon church bought much of the land where the Mormon renegades in northern Mexico lived. The difference between most of those polygamists who went to Mexico in the late 1800s, early 1900s, got routed out by Pancho Villa and returned to the United States and left everything they had down there, including the forebear of the LeBaron family. But then they went back after the revolution was over. Many of those Mormons went back, but they went back as members of the mainstream Mormon church and did not practice polygamy. The LeBaron family went down the patriarch, Almader LeBaron, went back there and did practice polygamy to such an extent that his family was really shunned and ostracized by the mainstream Mormons. So they went several miles south of the mainstream Mormon colonies, which are still there, and created their own colony, Colonia LeBaron.
How were they able to succeed over time and prosper, actually?
Well, they started their own church, the Church of the Fullness of... Actually, there were two different churches because there were rival leaders between LeBaron patriarchs who also claimed, in addition to practicing polygamy, they had this kind of what most would believe was an outrageous claim that they were carrying the mantle of Joseph Smith, that Joseph Smith had conveyed to the LeBaron men, particularly Almader LeBaron's originally firstborn son. All of the, there were six sons that all fought over this, but they claimed to be directly descended from Moses and Joseph Smith and Mary and Jesus, and that they were carrying the pure bloodline of Christ. And so that created, of course, conflicts with their neighbors who were mainstream Mormons, and then within their own family, which was a large polygamous family, it created conflicts and a blood feud between them. But they initially were very successful at proselytizing in Mexico and throughout the United States, and the colony grew and continued. It was pretty hard scrabble until they became very successful in agriculture closer to the 21st century.
Looking at the ethnic history of Colonial LeBaron, you had the original Mormons of European descent from the United States. Did they intermarry and intermingle with the Mexican residents of the area that they moved to?
Yeah, so that was very much a part of the early Mormon church, that they would be converting what they called the Lamanites, the Indians and indigenous people of Utah and the Southwest United States, and then in Mexico. So it was very much the, you know, European blonde, blue-eyed LeBaron family that then married, the men married different wives who were Mexican and the indigenous people from Mexico. And that caused also some conflict with their neighbors. You know, when you've got the patriarchal Mormons who are fundamentalists who are marrying their daughters, anyway, there just became a continuation of conflict between the LeBarons and their neighbors.
Closed polygamous colonies like that, if they're around for several decades, that can create some significant issues. And your book outlines some of those issues of incest that can lead to mental illness and instability. Is that the case with the LeBaron family?
Absolutely. I mean, it's not a, you know, polygamy apparently works for some people. It seems not to work overall for most people. It works for maybe for the patriarchs that have several wives. And again, this is to create as many children as you can to populate not just the kingdom of God on earth, but to populate the celestial kingdom. But it doesn't seem to work as well for many of the women who are basically pregnant from the time of their childbearing years until they can no longer bear children. And so, you know, you're looking at years of being pregnant and in an area that was very hard to live in, and it's an arid desert. So I think that there's, you know, it depends. When you've got these polygamous women, wives and children and young wives who become mothers early, most of them from Colonia LeBaron don't know any differently. They've been down there. Their mothers and grandmothers were raised in polygamy. There are several people that escape from time to time, and they write their memoirs and they, you know, bear witness to the situation. But, you know, generally, they're very protective of each other and their community. And the polygamy itself, because it's illegal still in both the United States and Mexico, creates a system of secrecy that, you know, they've been told all of their lives that we have to, you know, you don't go out into the world and admit to anything that's going on in our colony. And that, you know, creates a whole system, like you were talking, marrying cousins and the gene pool, you know, getting smaller and smaller, and the number of available young women getting smaller and smaller. So obviously, when it works, according to those who say it really has worked in their family, it sounds like a beautiful thing. There's lots of sister wives to help take care of each other's children. And for the most part, most of the women are down there navigating the businesses and the agriculture. And many of the men have other jobs up in the United States, and they come back, you know, once in a while. And also, as I said, polygamy is illegal. So they get around polygamy by only having one legal wife. And then the rest of the wives are common law wives. But that means that they don't have much agency as far as traveling back and forth across the border. They don't have birth certificates or social security cards like the men are dual American citizens. And so that creates an isolation and lack of information about the outside world that is changing. And I think that's what I really found in looking at the LeBaron, the victims in this horrible massacre. They were really kind of reaching, had one foot in each land as far as modern and primitive. And if you're familiar with the polygamous colonies from the United States, the Warren Jeffs and, you know, different things that have gotten a lot of attention. You know, most of the women, they're dressing in 19th century pioneer garb. And the LeBaron women are very much more modern. You know, they're wearing clothes like you would see on young women in America on college campuses. So it's very different.
So when a patriarch comes out, or one of the leaders of the colony itself, and they bring things up like the quorum of seven or seven wives are needed for that person to attain godhood, or they incorporate even wilder things like UFOs, extraterrestrials. You know, when is it religious zealotry, and then when is it just mental instability?
Well, I think that's what's hard to determine, and especially when you've got, as I mentioned, the celestial kingdom. I mean, the only vehicle for a woman to get to the afterlife and life everlasting is to be pulled there by a man. And it's a religion that is based on male supremacy. And, you know, all worthy men are able to communicate directly with God, which women are not. And so when you've got the patriarch at the dinner table saying, this is how it's going to go down, there's not a lot of avenue for discussion or disagreement. And that creates a very closed society that's very authoritarian.
There's a subjugation that's part of the colony, but with such a closed environment, no matter what they say, it can easily be accepted by the rest of the group.
Right. And that's going back to that. If they dictate this is how it's going to be, you know, in my book, I have a couple of people that, you know, lived many, many years in the colony and were married to patriarchs and had their hearts broken when the husband, you know, took another wife on the day they're delivering a child or whatever. And to see the heartbreak that comes with just basic human emotions of jealousy and sadness, your children are vying with each other against other wives' children. And it's like one of my sources said to me, so-and-so, you know, was practicing, he took another wife, and they jokingly behind the scenes called it being converted below the belt. So at what point, when is it a true believer and when is it a charlatan? And that becomes very difficult. Well, for outsiders, which are, you know, few, it becomes very difficult to know when this is really a holy man and this is somebody taking advantage of a situation that is very beneficial to the male members of the clan. And also, you know, it needs to be said that what happens too is there's a lot of the young, the teenage men, it's almost like the band of bachelors in a deer herd or something. There's no women left for them because all of the girls of childbearing age are spoken for by the patriarchs. So many of the young men, when they get to that, there's no encouragement for marriages between young women and men of the same age. So most of them go to the United States and work in construction and drywall and in the oil fields and, you know, try to make enough money to go back to Colonial LeBaron and get a farm for themselves and find a wife, which is pretty slim pickings.
Violence also was extended family on family as well. What happened in that mafia style hit that was ordered by, I think it's Irville LeBaron in the 70s?
Yeah, well, Joel LeBaron, his brother, was the one who was designated as carrying the mantle of Joseph Smith and was designated the one mighty and strong, which is called the White Horse Prophecy within the mainstream Mormon church, which they say is mostly a rhetorical device. It's not really believed, but it's based on a theory from the time of Joseph Smith that there would come a time when the United States government, the United States Constitution, which the Mormon church believed was divinely inspired, that it would be frayed and falling apart, and there would rise one mighty and strong, a Mormon leader who would take over the United States. And what happened was that Joel assumed that leadership role and the mantle, and his brother Ervil, who was overseeing a lot of the proselytizing and was kind of the scriptarian of Joel's breakoff church, decided that he, in fact, was the one mighty and strong, and arranged to have his brother Joel killed, and then went off on a murder spree throughout the United States, southwestern United States, killing as many as 50 people or having them killed. And many of the murder victims were killed after Ervil had died in prison. He was ultimately incarcerated for ordering the murder of Rulon Allred, one of his rival polygamists who led one of the most powerful polygamous Mormon groups in fundamentalist groups in Utah. So even after Ervil had gone to jail and died in jail, his offspring continued to kill for more than a decade.
Because Ervil goes to jail and then he has that influence even after he's in jail, is that why he's often referred to as the Mormon Manson?
Well, the Mormon Manson was, it was actually Jack Anderson, the nationally known investigative journalism, who himself was a Mormon from Salt Lake City, who was first writing about polygamy in the 1950s and then writing about the LeBaron clan. And he's the one who basically gave Ervil the moniker of the Mormon Manson because he was so violent and he was able to order his women, his wives and daughters to kill for him. And, you know, that's a whole other element of my story, which goes into a lot of different areas that I certainly never expected it to.
Does Ervil also get involved with drug traffickers or other crimes to help him carry out the violence against his brother sect?
Ervil was in charge of proselytizing in the United States and was a well-known figure around Las Vegas. The LeBarons considered America Babylon, and it was justified to bleed the beast, as they called it, which was to go up and engage in welfare fraud and, you know, different things. But he had a lot of contacts in Las Vegas, Nevada, and was trying to get money to build a casino on some land that the LeBarons owned in Baja California. And then his sons, while he was alive and then after he was dead, some of his children were running drugs out of Sonora, Mexico, into the 80s and into the 90s. So the family has a longstanding relationship with violence on both sides of the border and on both sides of the law.
There's an interesting circumstance that happens in 2009 when some of the drug cartels capture a 15-year-old from the colony and then try to demand $1 million for the return. That's an amazing story, too.
Yeah, and they ultimately, he's released. The family claims they didn't pay any kind of a ransom, but one of the confessors who admitted to abducting him said he was released because the family had indeed paid a ransom. But that led also to the murder of his older brother just a couple of months later that was blamed on the Sinaloa cartel and later blamed on the Juarez cartel. And, you know, 10 years later, then here's the massacre of these women and children who are directly related to both Eric and Benjamin, his brother, who was murdered.
There's an almost unbelievable, and I guess I don't even know what I'm saying because this entire story sounds unbelievable, but there is a crazy intersection between a man named Keith Raniere and the LeBarons. And for those that do not know the name Keith Raniere, he ran a sex cult in upstate New York called Nexium. And this goes back to that abduction or kidnapping of the LeBaron boy by the cartel. He's called down to the colony to help mediate the situation for some reason. I mean, just when you thought it couldn't get any wilder, how in the world does this happen?
Well, that was another of those complete curveballs in this story as I'm researching and writing it. But Keith Raniere was running the self-help group called NXIVM, N-X-I-V-M, in upstate New York, but he had a lot of followers. It was basically a pyramid scheme, and he had a lot of followers in Mexico. And he came up with this, his whole theory was kind of a life spring-like theory that you could stop violence by changing your mind. And so he ended up coming down to Colonia LeBaron and trying to convince them that if they followed his path toward nonviolence against the cartels, who had been their neighbors now for, you know, the LeBarons, Colonia LeBaron predated any of the cartels. So this is a long-standing neighborly relation, if you would call it that, between the cartels and the LeBarons. But Raniere somehow convinced them that they needed to start standing up to the cartels. And I think that's what really triggered even more violence against them, because before that, they gave the cartels wide berth and vice versa. And there was, they even called it a gentleman's agreement that they didn't tamp on each other's empires and domains. And that all changed with Raniere when he came down. He was trying to make a movie about it. And then he ultimately recruited several young women from Colonia LeBaron to go up to his compound in Albany, New York, ostensibly as nannies. And they ended up escaping and saying they were being groomed as sex slaves to Raniere. So that was just another segue into, there were so many intersections between this family and different moments in history and in contemporary culture, from El Chapo Guzman being incarcerated. So the whole area, I mean, he had been the head of the Sinaloa cartel for 3 decades. So the whole area was in chaos. And it just, by my looking at the massacre of these women, I ended up touching on a whole lot of different areas that all came together like a perfect storm in this area of northern Mexico, which is ground zero for drought and water shortages, which the LeBarons were accused of expropriating the water from their neighbors. And so there were a lot of different conflicts and alliances between the cartels, the pecan farmers, which were the LeBarons, the native indigenous subsistence farmers, the avocado growers, the lime growers, the agave growers for tequila. They all came together like a perfect storm in this one region where everybody was fighting for a dwindling supply of water. And these were all multi-billion dollar enterprises.
So in that water controversy, who's aligned with who? Are the LeBarons all off on their own, or do they have individuals that they're aligned with and other farmers have other, say, cartels and other individuals that they're aligned with?
Well, that's what made it so complicated, is because, first of all, we're going back generations. There are native, you know, neighbors who grew up down there, and the cartels are not, they're not outsiders. They're all born and raised in the region. And so there are conflicting relationships and longstanding familial relationships between the avocado growers and the marijuana and poppy growers. And we're talking going back hundreds of years in these relationships. And then you've got the LeBarons, they've got their own empire of pecan trees. Most of their labor force are neighboring Mexicans. So there's a lot of dovetailing between all these enterprises. It's very difficult to keep it all straight.
What's the school system like there in the LeBaron colony? And do they speak English or Spanish or both?
Both. And it's mostly homeschooled. I mean, I think there is a schoolhouse, and mostly I think the boys are more educated. The girls are more educated in domestic pursuits, but it's essentially homeschooling.
Do they have an interesting way of speaking because they grow up in a colony like that and they speak a mixture of Spanish and English?
It's a mixture. I mean, it's not that difficult for me to understand because I've lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico for 32 years where everybody speaks both. But they're very much Americanized, but also, you know, They're proud of being Mexicans. I see the LeBaron colony and the LeBaron family more like the Bundy family in Southern Nevada, who stood up to the U.S. government, the BLM, when they didn't want to pay their grazing rights fees. And, you know, there's this kind of sense of we're patriarchs and keep the government out of our business, both the United States government and the Mexican government, arm us, you know, leave us alone and let us have our own guns. And it's just it's a panoply of politics that is hard to comprehend, but very, you know, it's got the strain of the American patriot system and militia groups.
So if you look at the modern Mormon church and you compare it to what's going on in the colony, is it so significantly different now that they are just completely separate? Or is there any connective tissue at all between the two today?
I tend to think that the mainstream Mormon church right now has its hands full dealing with, you know, the recent abuses that have been exposed within the church from the Associated Press blockbuster recently about incest and sexual abuse within the church. And I know that I do believe that there needs to be a reckoning between the mainstream church and all of these fundamentalist polygamous colonies throughout the United States, because there are thousands and thousands and thousands of practicing polygamists. And by the church kind of dealing with them with a wink and a nod, it's pretty rare that you see any, you know, large scale attack on polygamists in the United States. And there may come a time when polygamy is legal again in the United States, when you consider same-sex marriage is a possibility, that could happen. But I just think that as long as the Mormon Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, contends that these are just renegade offshoots, they're going to continue to contend with these eruptions of violence and incest and bad news for the church.
Does the colony have a traditional temple, and do they follow a lot of the same rules that the Mormon Church still has or uses?
Not at all. They broke away. Joel LeBaron had his own church, and then when Erville took over, he started his own church. They do have a church meeting house in Colonial LeBaron, but it's not Mormon, and it's not even clear right now who's the leader and if there is anybody who's claiming to be the one mighty and strong and which one it would be. There's Adrian LeBaron, who is the father of one of the women who was murdered. And then there are a couple of other LeBarons that are, you know, strong patriarchal leaders in the community. But the religion itself seems to be thrown to the wayside for now.
Do they have any political impact there? I think it's in Chihuahua. Do they have like a voting bloc, like groups like that sometimes have?
Well, I think that's what really set them apart in the early days in the United States, is they voted in blocks. But I don't think they're large enough to have much impact that way. In Mexico, there's only between 3,000 and 5,000 of them there. But they are very impactful politically. You know, they do a lot of protesting. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see Adrian LeBaron, as I said, the father of one of the victims, see him run for political office. They're busy now trying to get sovereignty for themselves so that they're not ruled by the government of the state of Chihuahua. And they're constantly lobbying to get more weapons for themselves. So there's definitely a political bent to it, but I don't know how legitimately or how, you know, how strong it is. They're very anti-López Obrador, AMLO, the current president. They have a long-standing history with the old PRI ruling party for 75 years in Mexico. So, I mean, they definitely have a political agenda. Whether or not they have any juice, as they say in Las Vegas, is debatable.
Well, your book opens and ends with that incident in 2019. Could you talk about what specifically happened? How many vehicles were involved? What road they were traveling on? And then what happens in the aftermath? Did they actually burn the vehicles and the bodies and everything? I mean, what actually happens in that situation?
Well, there were three. They were traveling in three SUVs in a convoy together, one mother each driving each one with their children. And It was broad daylight. And after being on the road just a short time, 5 or 10 miles, the hitmen opened fire on them. And they were surrounded by armed men in the hills. They were going from La Mora, which is another fundamentalist colony in Sonora, the neighboring state of Chihuahua. And they were all interrelated. They were cousins and polygamous wives and daughters of polygamists. So they were heading to a wedding back in Colonia La Baron, which meant they were going up, you know, north on this remote dirt road, and then would take a right and go down into Chihuahua and south to Colonia La Baron. And one of the drivers, who had 4 of her children with her, she was continuing on to Phoenix, which was on the same road, but she would continue straight to Phoenix when they turned off to go to Chihuahua. And she was the one who I was convinced was the target because they just unleashed holy hell on her. There was something, I believe, it was 371 rounds of automatic fire into her car. And then ultimately, they burned her and 4 children, 2 infants, burned them alive in the car.
Wow.
And then the other 2 cars up ahead, both women were murdered and were killed by gunfire, and 2 of the children, and then several of the other children that were in there escaped. But from the beginning, I mean, this was broad daylight, and from the beginning, or at first, the Mexican government said it was a case of mistaken identity, and it was clear that it was not. You couldn't mistake them. And in fact, one of the women got out and put her hands up and said, "We're women, don't shoot. We're women and children." And as I said, it was broad daylight. And then the next thing the Mexican government said was they got caught in the crossfire. And that quickly became clear that that was not the case either. They weren't, for there were not 2 sides fighting each other, and these women were just driving through. And even the La Barons from the very beginning said, "We know we're targeted. This was not a matter of caught in the crossfire. We've all known each other here for generations. They know who we are." And they knew it was women and children. And as I said, I think at the beginning, there were 100 shooters. That's like, talk about overkill for 3, you know, unarmed women. So it was clear that it was either a message or a signal, or, you know, it was clear that it was intentional from the start. So then I started looking at why. That was, you know, for me, the first thing is, why are these women out there by themselves on one of the most dangerous roads in the world? I mean, not just a dangerous highway in the United States, but one of the major drug trafficking routes in the world for the Sinaloa cartel, which is the largest drug organization, most powerful and richest in the world. Why were they there? Where were the men? And the La Baron men, who are known for traveling this region, usually with an armed military escort. So where were the men? And then I explored this for 2.5 years of research, and spoke to a lot of people on both sides of the border and on both sides of the law, as I said before, and came down to the same conclusion at the end. Where were the men? Who lets their women and children go out like that into a war zone unprotected? And along the way, as you'll see, it's not really a whodunit. I knew from the beginning I probably was not going to be able to solve this crime. The Mexican government hasn't been able to. And I didn't have the subpoena power and access that they did. But so what I do, which I think would be satisfying for a reader, is to bring together all of the elements that played a role in it. And the reader can be as informed as I am about, you know, deciding what really went down here.
You're a very seasoned journalist. How difficult is it to gain information in such a closed society where people are used to secrecy, used to keeping secrets?
Well, I referred to that. I haven't talked about it with you, but that's one of the reasons that I decided to use some of my personal history in the book, which I've never done before. That's a real departure for me as a journalist. I never put myself in the story, but I'm descended from a long line of Mormon pioneer women and men. And I've written a book about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. I've written a book about my great-great-grandmother's conversion to Mormonism, and from England in 1849 and her trek to Salt Lake and being shocked to learn, as you mentioned at the beginning, that the church was practicing polygamy, because the proselytizers in England at that time were not pushing that forward. And she probably would never have joined if she knew. So I ended up using a lot of my personal history, which also, as it turned out, because of my readers from those two books, gave me access to people who would not normally have talked to me, and especially a lot of the women who had left the colony over the years, and even, you know, a lot of the descendants of the LeBarons who are still in the United States.
Well, the last question I have for you today is, what's the future of the colony? Is it withering on the vine? Is it thriving still? Or, you know, what's the future of the colony?
You know, it seems to me, I haven't been down there since this book came out, but from what I've heard, it's actually thriving. I think that some of the family members are really using this tragedy to actually to do what I write about in American Massacre, about Mountain Meadows Massacre, and what I think that the Mormons are famous for, and also which gets them in trouble more than anything, which is what I call the myth of persecution. All they have to do is raise the, you know, the clarion call that we're being persecuted as Mormons. And everything that I went through and all the people I talked to and all of the law enforcement and investigative stuff that I did, there was absolutely no indication that their Mormonism or religious practice or polygamy had anything whatsoever to do with this horrible massacre of these women and children. So I keep thinking, okay, what are you being persecuted for? They're thriving. They're millionaires. They're, you know, some of the largest nut growers in the world right now. And the community is thriving. So it's interesting because a lot of the victims of this massacre were from the community I mentioned, La Mora, over in the neighboring state of Sonora. And that community, it was smaller. It was only about 500, but probably more than half of the people in that community left and moved back to the United States. And those at Colonial LeBaron just dug their heels in even deeper. They're continuing to fight with their neighbors over the water. They're continuing to rabble rouse and draw attention to themselves and accusing, you know, the Juarez cartel of, well, you had asked about the end result. I mean, I think there have been as many as, you know, 65 or 70 people now arrested for the massacre, but nobody's actually been charged with the killings. Nobody's been charged. Whoever's been charged, they've been charged with connections to organized crime, which is kind of a benign way of, you know, a legal case. But nobody's gone to trial. Nobody's been indicted. Nobody's gone to jail. So it's easy for everybody to just identify with whatever the current, you know, they arrest somebody and parade him around, and then that's the last you ever hear of that guy. So, yeah, I think it's fair to say from all that I've heard that the community is thriving.
Well, Sally, thank you for your time today. I mean, it's an amazing story. You got polygamists and drug traffickers and murders and the sex cults involved. I mean, it is just a crazy story.
It is mind-blowing.
And an interesting read.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
I would like to thank my guest once again today, investigative reporter and prolific writer, Sally Denton. And if you would like to get her new book, The Colony, Faith in Blood and a Promised Land, simply click on the link in the description below. Of the book, Hampton Sides, New York Times bestselling author of Blood and Thunder, says, Denton burrows into a big, complicated tragedy that crosses borders and cultural divides. And she does so with imagination, resourcefulness, and investigative zeal. Our featured brew was Sucker Punch Watermelon Sour from Three Nations Brewing Company of Carrollton, Texas. If you enjoyed our talk today, please share this episode with a friend. And remember, subscribe to the podcast. For more information on authors and their books, like the History of Go-Go Facebook page. The music was provided by Rob Dufresne and the amazing North Carolina band, Bones Fork. And if you want to know what they have going on, just click on their link. It's in the description below as well. Finally, to that legion of listeners from around the globe, whether you're from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, or San Clemente, California, or from Villa Dolores, Argentina, or Mexico City, thank you. There are many more great episodes on the way, so join us again next time when we talk, think, and drink on History of Go-Go.
Blood Atonement. The theory is that if you commit a really serious sin, it can be forgiven, but you have to have your blood spilled to do it. it's supposed to be your choice. But Irvel LeBaron takes it one step further and says, hey, I'll administer it. I'll send you to heaven by spilling your blood.